Out there, oh, a peace is calling in the bonds of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or the churches. Today, I have invited Rod Oram to a Zoom recording for a broadcast. Rod, a warm welcome and hi mai to our radio program.
Oh, kia ora, Beate. Very lovely to talk to you again.
Rod Oram is a New Zealand business journalist, originally from the UK, who recently travelled to Glasgow for the COP26 conference on climate change. During this time, he was regularly giving feedback to the from the conference to the Religious Diversity Centre, and some of the recordings of these conversations are online and available on the RDC website. Thank you very much for reporting regularly from COP26, Rod. How do you feel now being back in New Zealand? Do you feel inspired or do you feel frustrated?
I'm trying to put frustration behind me because it's not entirely a useful response. I think we have to feel to some degree anxious and worried and frustrated that we humans are not responding quickly enough and deeply enough to these co-crises of climate breakdown and ecosystem collapse. And I think it's really important to think of those two together because one causes the other and vice versa. And solutions to one are often solutions to the other. So we're trying to put an awful lot right. So yes, to be frustrated, that is important. But for me, in many ways, the most remarkable thing about COP was a certain commonality I found about many of the people I talked to. And they held together, I think, three really important things. First of all, they were very clear-eyed about how great the crises are, how short the time is for us to work on them. Secondly, undaunted, they were very creative, very energetic, very determined to make a difference. And thirdly, they were very clear and direct about speaking the truth about that and being very direct with people who are not responding, but at the same time being very willing to work with a wide coalition of people to find help and allies wherever they might be. And of course, the combination of the three would vary from person to person. But what that meant was there was this extraordinary energy and commitment there, which was, first of all, very enthralling. It was deeply interesting. And it was very enlivening in terms of giving one a great sense of energy and commitment there. And I found that quite remarkable. I then was thinking about what is it that makes people like that. And of course, for each person, there's a very individual story there about things that in their life, what they see influences on them, and all the rest. And I didn't ask people, what motivates you, what makes you like you are. It's an incredibly important conversation to have, but in the hurly-burly of COP, one sort of jumped straight into the issues and started talking about those instead. So I have been thinking about that a lot, and the next point I'd want to make is very much a personal one, because it's just how I responded to all that, because I can't speak for everybody else. And in terms of my response, something quite extraordinary was going on in that everywhere I turned, there was a remarkable person to talk to. And whilst I was quite organized every day about what I was trying to focus on, given the agenda of the day and what was surfacing, so I had something of a plan every day, there was also a large part of serendipity in my response, just an encounter I might have or turn round a particular corner in the vast exhibition area and run into a pavilion I had no idea was there and found it completely fascinating. So there was.
Can you just say about the pavilions? Was there an exhibition together with a conference? Can you give a little?
Yes, thank you. It's really important to paint that picture. COP, in essence, consists of three different things. There is the formal UN negotiations, so that's very much a political process with politicians and government officials and all the rest engaged in those negotiations. Alongside that is a very big, I'm reluctant to use the word, but I will, expo, because that sounds a bit almost frivolous, a very large area of pavilions, all enclosed, in a big exhibition area, which was a combination of some, you know, some were plain country ones, talking about what the country is doing. Others were from a particular company or a particular industry. Others were from NGOs or other organizations. So there was this huge diversity there of, you know, almost every conceivable actor that you can imagine that's involved in this, explaining what they were doing and making that knowledge available. But then there's a third element, which is the civil society element. So in the exhibition area, that was quite heavily business and countries. But the civil society element of COP is incredibly important. So you can be a civil society delegate to COP rather than sort of a business one or a political one. And you can represent an NGO, a charity, a research organization, whatever. And I think that civil society function is incredibly important because unlike other international negotiations, which are very strongly political and government oriented, so the G20 or the G7 or APEC are very largely about governments. And in APEC, well, there's a business thing off to one side that has a input into the whole process. And when you get to the United Nations, yes, there's a very big civil society component in all of the UN's work, whether it be through the its own programs like the United Nations Development Programme or the Environment Programme or SCADs of others. When it gets down to the really hard negotiations, and I'm no expert on the UN, my sense is that it becomes intensely political, and therefore civil society gets pushed out of that. You know, to an extent, politicians will have taken on board some of that civil society response as they then negotiate. But it seems to me at COP that civil society presence is far more immediate and real and concrete. And I think that's really important because the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis, the ecosystem crisis, are not narrowly failures of a technology or an energy source that's got us into trouble. Fossil fuels. And the response is not simply a technology response. Oh, let's have EVs or let's let business lead on this. I mean, all of that's important. But the climate and biodiversity crisis are really whole of society crises. We've failed across a number of fields.
It's an interconnectedness that is different. Yeah.
That's right. And that's why I think the civil society response is incredibly important in COP. And there are some people who argue, well, the COP's just too big. It should be narrowly just governments negotiating treaties. And then you could have that all the rest of that stuff going on somewhere else some other time. Well, I think that's completely wrong. I think what really pushes governments to reach the agreements they do, often at the last, you know, the last 12 hours or so after 2 weeks of negotiations, is that civil society presence. So that's why I constantly refer to that and bring that to the fore. So, yeah, that's the basic structure. So that's why, as I was sort of going about my work at COP and trying to understand what was going on, I was trying to plug in as much to that as possible. And I didn't do nearly enough. I didn't get directly involved in the wonderful things that was going on with indigenous rights and knowledge, for example, which is taking an increasingly important role in at COP, and that was very much the case in Glasgow too. So, you know, there was a very tight limit to what I could do every day. But still, I was very conscious of all that. So as I was going about that, and I made, one other point, whilst from about 2 o'clock in the afternoon through to having to file at 5 p.m., Glasgow time to newsroom here in New Zealand, because it was 6 a.m. here in New Zealand, and my colleagues were very keen to get my report up on our website first thing in the morning. So apart from the 3 or 3.5 hours I was sort of head down in the media center writing, I would spend the maximum amount of time the rest of the day being out and about around that vast COP complex. And the most remarkable thing was, kind of like everywhere I turned, there would be an event, a person, an organization that I hadn't thought about, I hadn't expected to find, and there it was. And this is what is really hard to talk about, even for people like me with sort of strong faith. The Holy Spirit, I just felt, was sitting on my shoulder, and there's this stuff happening that I couldn't explain. It was completely extraordinary. And
so the Holy Spirit led you to the right people at the right time, and you had good discussions.
Yes. I'm not trying to second guess the Holy Spirit on this one, but I think there's another aspect of it. Because this is really hard to think about and talk about. And I'm very conscious that, I'm a business journalist. So what does it mean when a business journalist starts talking about this sort of thing? Does this mean that they're no longer pore over spreadsheets and financial analysis? I want to assure people I do. So what does it mean? And I'm still trying to work that out. But I think there's another really important part of the Holy Spirit, at least how I feel it, is that it's not that the Holy Spirit is I'm on autopilot and it's the Holy Spirit steering me around. I've always rejected that idea of sort of predestination in some form. But it's rather that it becomes a state of mind, or it opens up my mind to other possibilities. It makes me more open and more alert, more aware. And so I think that's a really important part of this. It's about, so if I try to understand what the Holy Spirit means to me, I think it's very much that. It grounds me in one way, but in other ways it opens me up to all sorts of other possibilities.
It's interesting that you mentioned this opening, because in Vatican II, the Pope said, let's open the doors and the windows and let the Holy Spirit come in. And you mentioned in one of the recordings with a religious diversity center, the expression, tsunami of the Holy Spirit or something like that?
Yes. I remember as I said that, I quickly, not backtracked, I sort of clarified that a little way, because we think of tsunamis as being fantastically destructive, which they can be, and one could dwell in an end-time view of the world where there is this amazing tsunami of the Spirit which sweeps everything before it. And I don't mean it in that sense. I do mean it in the sense of a tsunami which is a sort of there is some big force at work which has caused this upwelling of the ocean that just rolls through. And so I mean it in that kind of way rather than the apocalyptic sense of a tsunami.
In a way, it's when I think it more like the flood in Egypt, where it would bring make the ground fertile, because when the flooding was taking place regularly, that's when it became fertile. So in a way, the tsunami that you're talking about is creating the grounds for something positive.
Oh, that's a lovely, not even an analogy. It's a very real world example. Yeah, of a natural process happening to the benefit of nature and humankind.
Can you tell us more about the religions and the part of the religions that or faith groups that were present at the COP26? So I think that the spirit can work in many ways, but. And if you have people of faith, that you were mentioning the civil society, but you had people of faith there too, representing their faith group or praying. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I apologize and I feel badly about this, that it was just something I didn't lock on to specifically in my day. I'll come back to that point. Let me deal with that point first. Whilst I wasn't spending time in sort of contemplation and prayer and the like each day, just as that's sadly or well is not a regular part of my daily routine, I did find the 20-25 minute walk from where I was staying, and where I was staying was a very grounding place in terms of the neighborhood and my host. It was very, very real world. That 20-25 minute walk to the outer security fence of COP and then was unencumbered in the sense that I had this stroll through a fascinating old part of Glasgow. Much changed. It was the old docks and shipbuilding area. Now that's all gone. It's other things, including the Scottish Event Centre where COP was. But I found that time every day very contemplative, just turning things over in my mind. And likewise, the walk back home at the end, to my temporary home at the end of the day. And then once you get to the outer security fence and you had shown your credentials, you know, your pass, your photo ID, and your on your phone the result, your negative result of your daily COVID test, so you were allowed in, then there was a long security check and everything else, and you got drawn into the hurly-burly. So so that was the extent to which, I suppose, in a intentional way, I found time for contemplation each day, which I think is an important thing to do. So I didn't directly experience during those days at COP more direct experience of prayer, gathering of people. What the one thing that was noticeable was there was a few clergy around. I would guess they were Christian of some denomination. Certainly the purple shirts suggested some of them were bishops from whatever church.
Anglicans.
Yeah, probably. And very interestingly, clearly African Anglican, I would judge by a superficial sense of where they might have been from. And there was that. And I think that's a really important part of witness. I've once in a while met clergy people who, unusually these days, are very determined to wear their collar in public. And I think that's a really interesting question about again, it's, I suppose, a witnessing of a kind. But there was one extraordinary moment. I try and paint the picture for you. The whole complex was essentially, very big, but it was rather rectangular, so it was rather longer than it was wide. And running through the center of it, you could almost call it the main street of it, particularly in the exhibition area where you had all these pavilions off to one side and negotiating rooms off to the other. Through that long concourse there, there were trees, nice trees, in big pots that are obviously well looked after or might have been brought in for the occasion. And they were nice little bit of greenery and amidst a very artificial environment. And one time I was walking down there and a person had drawn, had taken a chair from the side and was sitting directly in front of one of those trees talking to it. And it seemed rude, or at least eavesdropping, to stop to listen too much to what he was saying out loud to this tree. But as I walked past, he was expressing great gratitude to the tree.
Oh, that's
for
wonderful.
Being the tree and doing what trees do. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. But what was to me even more interesting, again, this is so superficial because I have no idea who this person was or where they were from, but I sort of thought, possibly from the accent, that he was a white, middle-aged American of probably slightly younger than me, perhaps late 50s, early 60s. And I have no idea who he was and why he was talking. Well, he was obviously talking to the tree because he felt a relationship with that tree and was expressing his gratitude to the tree. And I thought that was completely wonderful. It was an intensely personal and human moment. There's no end of human moments at COP, but it's quite intriguing. So I can't tell you more. And I'm pretty sure there was a prayer room, because there would have been a lot of people there of faiths, obviously, particularly Islam, where prayer through the day is a really important part. So there was that. But my greater connection from a faith point of view was the interfaith work that was going on and was expressed out in public. So, for example, the interfaith vigil on the first day of COP, Saturday, the
31st of October or something like that.
31st of October, yep, absolutely. And that day had just been a formal, was it the Sunday? I'm sorry, I can't remember. It was the Sunday. It was the Sunday because Monday was the first, and so it was Sunday the 31st. And so that was the formal opening day of COP, and there wasn't a lot going on other than formal opening proceedings. But that's when the vigil was. And this had been wonderfully organised by Interfaith Scotland, which is based in Glasgow, and it was naturally played an important hosting role to interfaith communities from around the world. And I heard later from Maureen Sire, the wonderful person from Interfaith Scotland, that some 10,000 people had logged on to the live stream of that from around the world. And then after that, there was an interfaith declaration with people from many faiths speaking briefly in that. And this is all in George Square, the largest public square in Glasgow. And then from there, quite a few people went off to the Garden Hill Synagogue in Glasgow, which hosted a Talanoa dialogue, a Pacific-style dialogue on climate and faith issues, and then a worship service in the synagogue, which I thought was quite wonderful. Sadly, I didn't have a chance to go to that. And some 200 people were involved with that, either in person or virtually online in real time. And then there were many, many other particular faith organizations or interfaith organizations or NGOs with a faith base. You know, Caritas, for example, was very evident at COP. So there was a lot going on. And I'm really sorry that I can't give you chapter and verse on more, because in terms of the decisions I was making each day about what I was going to focus on.
You really need to have a team, yeah. And each one goes at a different place at a different time.
I thought at one point, look, if I could replay, if I got stuck in some kind of strange time warp and I didn't have a new day every day, but I just keep reliving the same day, I could have an infinite number of different days just in terms of the things I could have done on that day and who I could have talked to. But I had also made a very firm commitment to myself before I went, and I was trying to think through what it'd be like at COP. Look, just make the most of wherever you are at a moment. Don't suddenly realize that, oh my goodness, something amazing was going on somewhere else and I really wished I'd been there. Well, I wasn't there. I'm here. So just concentrate on where you are and make the most of that. So it was a no regrets policy about the decisions I made to where I would go. And it was all a question about making the most of those decisions.
Thank you so much, Rod. That was really interesting insight in COP26, because we are here so far away and yet we were connected through the vigil prayer, which some people watched here also in New Zealand. And I think it was, if you include the online audience, it would certainly have been an event that has spread through all the nations or almost all nations.
Oh, hugely. And I think that's incredibly important about the power of technology today, to be able to connect people in real time if they want to or can, or later in the day if they can't, to these events. And I had thought about just trying to cover COP from here, even to keeping Glasgow hours. And I could have done an awful lot, but there would have been no substitute for being there, and indeed was the case. However, there is this huge value of being able to feel connected in that way. And I'm very grateful to the people here, some of whom are the organizers, our friends, who were involved involved in the prayer vigil here, Karakia for Climate, because I was very conscious of that through COP, and it meant a great deal to me.
Thank you so much, Rod, and I wish you all the best, and let's see what COP26, what we'll have between COP26 and COP27. Hopefully we'll have some positive tsunami of the Holy Spirit. And so thank you very much for this interview. And I just want to say to the listeners, there are two events coming up. On Monday, the 6th of December, I will give a presentation on nativity scenes. And on the 17th of December, there will be a conversation between Professor Thomas O'Loughlin and Brother Kieran Finn on joy at Mass. So all events are on the website, and please have a look at www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha, keep safe, and thank you, Rod, for coming to the interview.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Out there, oh, peace is calling in the bonds of love we meet, for the world a new day dawning and shining.